Matt Taibbi is a journalist who has written five previous books, including the best-selling Griftopia, and that was a look at the banking system and some of the scandals that went on there. He's also been a contributing editor for many years to Rolling Stone magazine. Matt Taibbi, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, tell me a little bit about the genesis for why you wanted to write this book. I guess my most basic question is, we've known since the beginning of time that rich people get a fairer shake of justice than poor people because of their resources. Why now?
Well, sort of the genesis for me was that I've been covering Wall Street since 2008, since the crash, and I had been covering caper after caper where there were these elaborate, sometimes criminal schemes where there was tremendous social destruction and wealth destruction, and nobody was getting indicted and nobody was going to jail in every single case. And I started to become interested in that phenomenon. And around the time of the Occupy protests, I thought about making it into a book. And just to do my due diligence, I started to listen to who does go to jail in this country and for what. And I was so overwhelmed by the contrast that was why I ended up having to do this project. I think I actually didn't put this in the book, but there was a process of discovery for me in writing this. You know, as a middle to upper class white person, there were things that I just didn't know about how easy it is to go to jail for people without means in this country that were so shocking in comparison to the things that I had been covering that I felt compelled to write about this.
In your book, you contrast what was going on in the banking industry and the fines, if you can call it that, of some of the big players. But you contrast that also with just some ordinary folks on the street who were being, you know, rounded up by the police and brought in. Can you talk a little bit about that contrast and how you decided to approach the book from that angle?
So I think originally the first time that I thought to make that comparison was when they announced the settlement with HSBC. If you remember, this was a couple of years ago. HSBC is one of the biggest banks in the world. It's the largest bank in Europe. It was sort of hauled in by the American Department of Justice for a variety of money laundering offenses. They were accused of laundering money for sanctioned nations, for Russian mobsters, for people with terrorist ties, and most notably for laundering over $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels, including the infamous Sinaloa cartel, which is suspected in thousands of murders. And for those offenses, which they admitted to in the settlement, and they paid a $1.9 billion fine in the settlement, they got a complete and total walk. There was nobody, except for the money, there were no consequences for any individuals. And I was watching this. You know, they made the announcement in New York, and it struck me that here's a company that has aided and abetted people at the very top of the illegal narcotics trade. And they're getting no jail time. They're not even being brought into court. And meanwhile, on that very day, there are people going to jail for being at the bottom of the illegal narcotics trade. And I rushed over to the other criminal court in New York and asked around some of the public defenders. I said, "What's the dumbest drug case you had today?" And I found a person who got 47 days in Rikers for having a joint in his pocket, which incidentally is not even illegal in New York City. That was the comparison for me, that here we have people who committed offenses on a mass scale at the highest level, and they were allowed to pay a fine and go home and sleep in their own beds. And people who are the consumers of the same activity, the lowest level offenders, are getting jail time in one of the worst jails in America.
One of the things you document, kind of extending from that, is this process where the New York police would go around and round people up in kind of a quota system. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this all goes back to the so-called broken windows policing theory, where if folks remember in the early 90s, there was this whole movement towards statistics-based policing in lots of inner-city communities across America, but particularly in New York. And the theory there was if people know that they're going to be arrested for jumping a subway turnstile, they're much less likely to bring an illegal gun out on the street with them. So police would fan out into neighborhoods, and they would basically pick people up for every little thing you can think of, whether it's an open container violation or riding the wrong way down a sidewalk with your bicycle, or in some cases, or jumping a fare in a subway, or even, as I found out in this book, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which basically means just standing on a street corner in a place where the police don't like it. They bring all these people in, and ostensibly what they're doing is they're looking for people with guns or warrants, and they're supposed to throw the innocent people back, but they don't always do that in practice. As I found out, they hand out summonses, and they bring people in and keep them in jail and strip search them and have them go through all these terrible processes. That's very demeaning and very angering, and it's all part and parcel of this strategy to target inner city crime that I think is kind of spiraled out of control.
And we've certainly seen a dramatic increase in the prison population in recent years. Is this contributing to part of that?
Absolutely. There's this sort of bizarre statistical mystery that I talk about in the beginning of the book, where violent crime has actually been crime of all persuasions has been dropping in America since 1990. It's declined 44%, according to federal statistics. But the prison population has more than doubled since then. It's gone from 1 million to 2.2 million. So how does that make sense? Something doesn't add up, and that was part of what led me to investigate this book.
We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He is the author of The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. We'll be taking your questions here on the Jefferson Exchange right after a short break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He's the author of the book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. This is his fifth book. He's had some New York Times bestsellers, including Griftopia, and a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine for many years. As I read through your book, Matt, I got the sense that this is not a political persuasion type problem where you can indict liberals or conservatives exclusively. For the last several administrations, we've had this sort of turning a blind eye to some of these too big to fail, so to speak, businesses.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, that this is definitely not a left or right issue. In fact, I tried to kind of make the point that one of the reasons that I think this phenomenon has developed in the direction that it has is that in the Clinton years, the Clinton administration made a two key political decisions. One is that they went for the whole welfare reform thing, basically realizing that there was political opportunity, political hay to be made by criticizing people on welfare. And the other thing was that they made a conscious effort to court Wall Street and court the financial services sector, and adjust their policies accordingly. And whether or not you agree with those decisions or not, the important point here is that there was now political consensus on both issues. Neither party was now a place where the you know, poor people and people on public assistance had a natural lobby. And also, both parties were a place where the financial services sector did have a lobby. And so I think that's why we've seen a kind of advancement on both fronts. And you're right, it doesn't have to do with either party. I think both parties are mostly in agreement about these phenomena.
If you have a question for Matt today, give us a call, 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have Michael on the line from Mendocino. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, good morning. Mr. Diaby, could you give me your critique on the corrosiveness of Money 3 on the money policy of this country? And two, if you could comment on the politics of scarcity in this new age revolution of technology that we have. And one final comment, have you ever thought of having your own radio show to follow through with all this? Because to be honest with you, it's too long between your books. And I sure appreciate what you're doing. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Answer to the last part first. Definitely not considering doing my own. I think I'll leave that to folks like Milta. I actually grew up in a family of broadcast journalists. My father was a television reporter, and my stepmother was a television reporter, and so I know how hard that job is. And writing occasionally is a much better deal from my vantage point than being on the air every single day. I think as most broadcast folks would attest to, it's a very, very tough job. So I'm not going to do that. To comment, I'm sorry. I think I'm not quite sure about the first part of your question. You wanted me to comment on Fed policy. Is that what it is?
I think that's what he meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously the Fed played an enormous role in all of the scandals leading up to after the 1987 crash, before the tech bubble in the early 90s, the subprime mortgage scandal. We saw the same behavior over and over again, which is that every time Wall Street got itself in trouble, the Fed stepped in and made it easy for these folks to borrow their way out of trouble again. And now we're in a situation where simply making money cheap for Wall Street hasn't been enough, and we now have this quantitative easing policy, which essentially is a kind of ongoing subsidy of the financial services sector, where they're pumping, you know, $45 billion a month into the economy. And everybody's concerned about what's going to happen when that spigot gets turned off. Everybody's worried that there's going to be another bursting of a bubble, because what happens when you stop putting $45 billion a month into the economy? Nobody knows. I think it's definitely a worry that Americans should have. We should be educate ourselves more about the role of the Fed in our lives, because it is a sort of extra-governmental, extra-democratic force that plays an enormous role in our day-to-day existence, and we have to think about it more and more.
Steve is on the line from Eugene about how we got into this situation. Go ahead, Steve.
Howdy. I don't think your book's really going to be all that informative unless you get past the present and put some contextual basis on how we got here in the first place, which I put back to Ronald Reagan when he said, well, we're going to lower taxes and make more money because of our aptly named Laffer curve. And they're laughing all the way to the bank. And yeah, it's trickling down, but it's yellow and foamy and it don't taste like beer. Now, the biggest, in my memory, industrial boom we ever had in the United States was back in the 50s and the 60s, when taxes on the rich were 90%, and CEOs were making about 40 times the wages of the working class. Now we've got a tax system where people like Mitt Romney are paying 14% on billions of dollars of income, and the working man is still paying 23%, 24%, whatever the case may be.
Right.
And that is the inequality that is driving the, the one percenters to maybe in another 100 years becoming the 1/10 of 1 percenters that are owning 75% of all the resources in this country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Steve. What about that, Matt? Because inequality is at the heart of your book, isn't it?
Sure, of course. And I think that's a great question. And what's the genesis of all this? I think there's actually kind of a larger philosophical point to be made here, which is that a lot of the behavior that we've seen in the financial services sector, and frankly in some other sectors as well, like the pharmaceutical sector, we've seen a lot of behavior that is starkly unpatriotic. You know, where you see high-ranking executives from some of the biggest companies in the world engaging in socially non-productive activities. In the finance sector, for instance, the whole subprime mortgage boom was basically a con scheme where the banks would create these huge masses of underperforming and very risky loans and disguise them as AAA-rated securities and then go off and sell them to institutional investors like pension funds and foreign trade unions and foreign hedge funds. So they were just creating a bunch of worthless stuff and selling them off to people. And yes, that made them a lot of money, but it didn't really do anything in terms of helping build America. And what's important about this is that there was once upon a time, and it wasn't too long ago, people in the financial services sector felt connected to the rest of the country. They felt like they had an important role. Their job was to help marry good ideas to financing to help build the industrial power of this country and create jobs. And somewhere along the line, I think it was sort of around the Gordon Gekko era, you know, a lot of people talk about the influence of the movie Wall Street, where suddenly it wasn't about building things and making money over the long haul and in a slow and methodical fashion. Suddenly it was about making as much money as you could, as fast as you could, and getting out and living the high life. And people stopped feeling like they had a role in society, and that has led to a lot of this sort of sociopathic criminal behavior. And that's what happens when people don't feel like they have a future. They start behaving criminally, and that's an important thing to think about, is when did we lose faith in our future, and we have to get people back to thinking that there is a future for this country.
We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He's the author of the new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Wolfgang, you're on the line from Sunny Valley.
Good morning. It really is sunny. Nice.
Good.
I would like to take this down to the normal life of the normal person who doesn't have the millions, who doesn't invest his excess because he doesn't have an excess, who doesn't have a pension fund or any of that. But the divide of justice between rich and average or poor is in daily life. The normal person out there is subjected to administrative law, has no clue, doesn't understand the laws, can't afford a lawyer, and if they afford a lawyer, they don't know what to ask the lawyer, and lawyers always do what they're told, basically. So they have no chance of ever being a partner in this whole legal game. The agencies, a bad neighbor can hurt your life, can destroy your life. You have no chance. So it's the general powerlessness of the normal person versus the legal system is, I think, more closely. I mean, you're talking about the big stuff, and but it's out there. What I'm interested in is what's really in there, in people's lives, in their daily existence, you know. And so plus you have the impenetrable maze of how all these laws are administrated. You can't get through.
Yeah, if you don't have a strong enough legal team to wade through all of this, what about that, Matt?
No, it's Wolfgang, right?
Yeah.
It's a great question. I spent a lot of time in this book about on that very issue because it's absolutely true, and I interviewed countless people who, for instance, had been accused of welfare fraud or who had been accused of welfare fraud or other minor crimes. For those people, for people without means, it is extremely difficult to succeed in the criminal justice system. Once you get caught up in a case, it can take over your life in a way that is overwhelming. And I'll give you an example. In New York, for instance, we have speedy trial laws, right? So theoretically, if you're arrested on a misdemeanor, they're supposed to either take you to court or drop your case within 90 days. But what they do is they put you, if you can't make bail, you're in jail, you're waiting, you go to your first court date, and the prosecutor says, sorry, Your Honor, we're not ready to proceed today, and the judge reschedules you for 2 months later. Now, by law, theoretically, the court is supposed to charge the prosecution for those 2 months and towards your 90 days. But what they do instead is they turn around the next day and they file what they call a certificate of readiness, which says, yes, we weren't ready to proceed yesterday, but we are ready to proceed today. So now that the case has been rescheduled, the prosecutors are not going to be charged for, say, 60 days or 65 days. They're only going to be charged for 1 day. And because of that, this person can now stay in jail indefinitely, even though by law he's supposed to be out or convicted within 90 days. So the system just does not favor people who don't have money. If you can't afford bail, if you can't afford a good lawyer, and you don't know what questions to ask, and you don't know how to navigate the system, you're in serious trouble. I mean, once you get caught up in it, whether it's a good case or a bad case, it doesn't matter. You're in trouble. Whereas on the flip side, it's almost impossible. If you commit a crime anywhere short of murder, you're going to be out on bail at the very least, and you may even be out after conviction, pending appeal. And it's just so much easier for people in that position, and I tried to draw that contrast.
We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He's the author of the new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. If you have a question, 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let's check in now with Mark, who is in Reading. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning. Isn't the basis of incorporation to avoid personal responsibility?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
it seems to be working for those who are incorporated. Maybe we should all incorporate.
Well, but isn't that what the author Ambrose Bierce once said, that a corporation was an ingenious device for obtaining individual profit without individual responsibility? And that's kind of what we've got now. We have the system that basically says to you, if you commit a very serious offense, but you do it within the confines of a gigantic corporation that is systemically important to the world economy, then you're going to get off without any individual punishment. At the very worst, your company is going to pay a fine, and you yourself won't suffer. Whereas the individual is not part of a corporation. The individual is caught up in the same criminal justice system that we all come to know and love, where you may end up in jail and you may end up with other consequences, like having the custody of your kids taken away from you, or having all of your assets seized. But that doesn't happen to you if you are a wrongdoer in one of these too big to fail companies. So that's a very good point that you're making.
And for folks who are on the poor end of the scale and have to go through a public defender, I mean, the public defender's offices across the country are just swamped, aren't they? They really don't have the time to deal much with individuals.
No, and I talk to a lot of public defenders, and by and large, they're great people, and they're idealistic. They want to do the right thing. They desperately want to do the right thing by their clients. Many of them consciously chose careers as public defenders over high-paying corporate jobs because they just wanted to be able to sleep better at night, and they wanted to work for clients who they liked. But they're overwhelmed. They have, if you see a public defender in a courthouse, the chances are that he or she is carrying a stack of folders that extends over his or her head. They have so many cases they don't know what to do with. There aren't enough hours in the day. And they're very often put in a position where they don't know how to advise their clients. Their clients may be caught up in a bad case, but as I said before, if they fight it out, they may end up spending more time in jail than they would if they were convicted. So what do you do if you're a public defender in that situation? Do you advise the person to take the plea, or do you advise the person to fight it out, especially if the person has a family, if they have kids? It's an awful situation, and the lawyers are overwhelmed. And on top of all that, the judges have tremendous contempt for public defenders. They treat them so differently than they treat the well-paid lawyers who represent these companies that was another thing I was very much struck by.
A lot of public defenders are also young, aren't they? They're just starting out in their careers.
They are, and that's not necessarily a strike against them, because being young and energetic can help in these instances, because you need the energy to fight out some of these cases. But let's face it, having experience and being a little bit older, and also especially knowing all the judges, is a much bigger asset.
We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He's the author of the book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. We're taking your questions here on the Jefferson Exchange, and we'll be back with the final segment of the day right after this short break. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Matt Taibbi. He's the author of the new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Let's go to Jim in Ashland. You're on the air, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Matt, I'm really happy to hear your voice here locally. I've heard you on national broadcast this week, and appreciate your being here.
Thank you. You're
welcome. I have a question about your opinion on it's kind of the three legs of government issue. You know, we obviously, congressional elections are determined by big money. Even the Obama administration's taking in big money, and they've taken the stance that the financial sector's too big to fail or even fine, let alone put into jail. And then there's the third leg of government, which is the Supreme Court, and the recent decision, for campaign contributions, and then the prior one for People, Youth versus United. Would you make a comment on both the Supreme Court perspective and the loss of what I would consider integrity to big money, and then also the other two legs in relationship to that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's all the same question, right? I mean, well, let's take the Supreme Court first. The Citizens United decision has had a catastrophic effect on politics in this country. I was talking to a journalist who has been covering campaign finance reform for years, and he was joking that the situation in the post-Citizens United's age is so hopeless for activists on that front that they might as well just go into some other line of work, grooming miniature dogs or handling medical waste or something like that. It's so dire now. There's just no way to control the influence of money in politics anymore. And money in politics was always a serious problem, but it's gotten significantly worse now. And with the financial services sector, the reason that this is so troubling is that this is a sector of the economy that is very cash rich. They are very smart about making investments And they realize that the best investments that they can make are political investments, that spending a dollar on supporting a candidate may mean $100 or $200 or $300 down the road, or your physical freedom. And so that's why they heavily support candidates from both parties. They exercise an enormous amount of influence on members of the House and the Senate by waving a lot of money around. And this is why we haven't seen a lot of movement on issues where actually, if you ask members of Congress in private what they think about issues like Too Big to Fail, a lot of them will tell you, look, I'm with you. You know, these companies, if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. On the right, they say we don't want to have to bail them out again. On the left, they say we're afraid of the overweening corporate influence. But nothing ever gets done about it, and that's because there's a significant plurality of people in government who are afraid of having that spigot of Wall Street money turned off, because it's just too hard to run for elections without that money. And so it's a serious problem. Until they get that fixed, it's hard to know exactly how much of this can get fixed, because the money is always going to rule the day.
Bill is on the line from Medford. Go ahead, Bill.
Matt, I agree with a lot of your position on what you say, but one comment that you made that I don't agree with at all, mm-hmm. and that is your comment to the effect that the judges have contempt for the public defenders. That's just plain not true.
Your response, Matt?
Well, I mean, maybe it's not the public defenders they have contempt for. Maybe it's their clients. But I can tell you that I spent countless hours in courtrooms in my research for this book, and every time a public defender tried to argue a point of law with a judge, the judges would roll their eyes. They would maybe consider it cursorily, and sometimes they would think about giving relief to the defendant, but most of the time they were upset because there was the perception that this is a socially non-productive person who was in the courtroom, who had yet again been arrested for some nuisance crime like a property crime or prostitution or drug dealing, and they didn't have any patience for that person. On the other hand, I spent a lot of time also in courtrooms for both civil and criminal charges involving white-collar defendants. And I can tell you that judges listen quite a lot more to the lawyers on that side of the bar. And in fact, they will often actually actively solicit advice from the huge masses of lawyers, because there's always not just one. There's always a gaggle of 10 or 15 or 20 who are sitting defending people from, say, a gang of banks accused of municipal bond bid rigging. And they listen to those lawyers a lot more. And culturally, I think they feel a little bit more simpatico toward the people who are on the dock for those kinds of offenses. So I take your point. Maybe it's not contempt that I'm thinking of, but it's a different attitude, that's for sure.
Nobody ever brings a camera into the courtroom for a low-level street crime, do they?
No, they don't, and they don't. And although, to be fair, they don't always bring a camera in the courtroom for a high-level lawsuit involving subprime mortgage fraud either. That was another thing that was striking to me, is that there were almost never any press at a lot of these high-level Wall Street court cases. They're just too hard to cover for ordinary journalists, and mm-hmm. they take much time, and so... that was another thing that was interesting.
Banking is never very visual, is it?
No, it's very hard to make sexy. And look, you know, we're in the commercial. Well, you're not, but I am. I'm in the commercial news media business, and it's a business where they're trying to make money. And in order to get eyeballs, how are you going to get eyeballs explaining bid rigging in the municipal bond business? I mean, it took almost two full days to explain what it even was to the jury when I went to that trial. Think about how hard, about the challenges a journalist face covering that kind of a story, and you begin to see why it's not covered so much.
Skeeter is on the line from Eugene with a question. Go ahead, Skeeter.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you so much for this program. Matt, thank you for your diligence and your researching and getting this information out. It's crucial.
Oh, well, thank you.
You know, I'm really frustrated with the Obama administration. I feel like we got fooled again. I mean, not only is this Justice Department not doing a good job, the regulators are not doing a good job. Obama helped squash the Occupy movement, which has really been trying to point out these inequalities. I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering about some possible remedies that we, the people, the taxpayers, can do here, and such as divesting from corporations and big banks, withdrawing the money, boycott efforts. Do we organize as the Greens Party somehow and start electing people that we can trust that will do the right thing? What do you suggest? And once again, thank you.
Oh, thanks for the question. That's a tough one. You know, I mean, I get that question a lot. And as a reporter, I have to say solutions are not my strong point. I spend a lot of time describing what is and what's going on. It's harder. It's much murkier to think about how we fix all these problems. I know that I've talked to a lot of people who do think about how to fix these issues, and I've come around to the opinion that the fastest route to all of this getting sorted out is to break up the too big to fail companies. That's the first thing, because the business community will reform itself very quickly if bad and corrupt and inefficient and stupid companies are allowed to go out of business, which they were not after 2008. And I think it's been a major failing of the Obama administration that they have not recognized the serious kind of moral hazard problem posed by the fact that the response to the 2008 crash was not just to bail out all of those companies, but also in many cases to merge them together and make them bigger and more dangerous, and less, and make it less possible for us to allow them to go out of business. We're at a point now where the heads of most of the regional Federal Reserve branches and many members in the Senate and the Congress all believe that these companies need to be broken up, and I think they just need a little push. I think they need public demonstrations. Maybe they need a candidate who's heavily supported by the public, who is going to stamp his or her foot on this issue, and that would be a huge first step. I mean, I there are many other things that one could think of, but that's the one that I keep coming back to, and I think it might. I think it's possible too, and I think that's why it's so interesting.
Matt, would you, and kind of, I think, connected to this, would you elaborate a little bit on that Eric Holder document from 1999 and how that played into what's been happening recently?
Sure, yeah. Way back in 1999, when Eric Holder was a deputy attorney general for the Clinton administration, he wrote a thing that came affectionately to be known as the Holder Memo, where, among other things, he laid out a policy called the Collateral Consequences Policy. And all it said was, if you're a prosecutor and you're targeting a big company that employs a lot of people, and you, the prosecutor, are worried about innocent victims like shareholders or executives who didn't have any role in the wrongdoing, or maybe the community where the company was situated, you can seek other remedies like non-prosecution agreements or deferred prosecution agreements or fines. And this is a sensible policy. I mean, you don't want to have to destroy a company every time some idiot executive does something wrong. But the problem is that when he came back into office as Attorney General, now the whole financial landscape is dominated by these too big to fail companies, where if you move against them criminally, if you file criminal charges against the firm, it really would have catastrophic consequences in many cases. I mean, look what happened when Lehman Brothers went out of business. So can we risk that? We probably can't. The problem is that they've now begun to conflate that with a policy of not prosecuting individuals at these companies. It's one thing to not prosecute the company criminally, but they're not going after individuals either. And there's no reason for that. Like, take the HSBC case. Again, I can understand not wanting to risk the health of the largest bank in Europe, but there's no reason we should let an individual get away with laundering money for the Sinaloa drug cartel. That can't happen. I mean, that's a crime that people get 20 years for. So somebody has to do time for that, and that doesn't make any sense.
We have Carly calling from the Applegate. You're on the air, Carly.
Good morning. Hi, Matt. I heard you on NPR yesterday, and I was really impressed.
Oh, well, thank you.
You were speaking about a woman that was prosecuted for fraud, for welfare fraud, and the police came in and went through her underwear drawer.
Right, yeah.
I was really shocked by that. But anyway, I heard about a case in the media last summer where a woman got 25 years in prison for firing a warning shot on an individual, a man that had a history of abusing her.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about that case?
I didn't know, but I mean, I imagine that it's true. Sure, yeah.
Well, anyway, a little juxtaposition here. I was walking my dog on a BLM road, Bureau of Land Management road near my property. And I got a warning shot from a very successful miner.
Uh-huh.
And the law enforcement came and told him that he needed to be a better neighbor.
Okay, Carly, we need to have him address that. We're running a little short on time here, but
sure.
Go ahead, Matt.
Sure. Well, look, Carly, that's a great question. And this whole thing, the whole issue that I'm trying to get at is about prosecutorial discretion, because the law is the law. Under the law, we're all equal. There's no room in what's written for anybody to get special treatment. But there is plenty of room in the discretion of the prosecutor, and the prosecutors may decide that a rich miner shouldn't get 25 years in jail for discharging a weapon near his property, while they may decide something else entirely for someone who's of less means. And that's what this entire issue is about for me, is what goes into those calculations. How do we decide who gets the hammer dropped on them and who doesn't? And because there's an extraordinary sort of spectrum of consequences for people who commit crimes, and some of them are incredibly severe, and some of them are just a verbal warning. And who's to say when, how do we regulate those decisions? And that's an important question.
Our guest this morning has been Matt Taibbi. He is the author of the book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. This is your fifth book, I believe, Matt, and thank you so much for being on The Exchange this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, that's it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects, or even suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We also provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening during the morning hours, Here and Now is coming up next. And if you're listening to the evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. The Exchange is produced by the JPR Foundation as a public service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our producer of The Exchange is Charlotte Duran. I'm Milt Radford. Thanks for listening.